So what does a storm of that nature mean to the radioactive wreckage of the triple meltdown Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactors? The Japanese government and Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, have admitted that warning alarms went off at Fukushima, but both are either offering empty assurances that everything's A-OK or avoiding the subject entirely. So then, when you hear a genuine nuclear expert who's been following Fukushima closely since the nuclear disaster started more than 8.5 years ago tells you...
What they haven't talked about is finding water inside the reactor buildings. And that's what we worry about, is how much water was coming in through, you know, the holes in the roof, the broken walls, all these other things with the damaged reactors, because those buildings are still full of contaminated debris to a certain extent, depending on their unit. So we worry about water coming into those and then moving things out into the environment.
Well, when you hear something like that from someone as trustworthy as Nancy Faust of Simply Info, you can be well advised that you are indeed sitting in that uncomfortable seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, two breaking stories. Hurricane Hagibis wreaked havoc on Japan last weekend, triggering warning alarms at the wreckage of the triple nuclear meltdown at Fukushima Daiichi, as well as having bags of previously decontaminated debris being washed into local rivers. But what does it all mean? Nancy Faust of Simply Info explains what is at stake in this still-breaking story. And Randy Stafford, a citizen activist concerned about radiation contamination at Rocky Flats, brings us up to date on planned construction of a toll road adjacent to the Rocky Flats Radioactive Superfund site. Randy made a unique and powerful contribution to the current citizen fight back to that toll road. And note that as we went into production, he contacted me with a breaking news update, information just announced today, that greatly changes the future of that planned toll road. You will hear all about that as well. Plus, we'll also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than seems to be coming out of post-Hurricane Hagibis Japan right now. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 15, 2019, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. The big story this week is Hurricane Hagibis, which hit Japan with massive force. The storm was the largest to hit the island nation since 1958. It had winds that exceeded 150 miles per hour, and it dumped more than 3 feet of water in 24 hours in some places. Alarms went off at the remains of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power station, the site of the triple meltdown in 2011, and the city of Tamura in Fukushima Prefecture said on Sunday that an unknown number of bags containing contaminated waste from the plant were lost. Officials said heavy rains carried the bags to the nearby Furumichi River that connects to another river and flows into the Pacific Ocean. The city says it has retrieved 10 bags, though did not admit whether they had been opened or not, and there is some controversy and misunderstanding about the number of these bags that were swept away. We'll have more on that in a moment. Know that when they say bags of debris, it's not the same as one of your green plastic garbage bags. Each of these bags weighs more than 1 ton and the plastic material of which they were fabricated was anticipated to last only 5 to 7 years before the toxic debris would require a final dumping place. Many bags that were not washed away have been damaged by wind and rain already, and the radioactive contents spread by wind and water. To find out more about what this means, we spoke with Nancy Faust. She is communications manager and research team member at simplyinfo.org, a not-for-profit research collective that holds and manages the world's largest public archive of data on the Fukushima disaster. She and I spoke on Monday, October 14, 2019.
Nancy Faust from Simply Info. Thanks for joining us on short notice here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Great to be here.
Let's first talk about what we currently know about the impact of Hurricane Hagibis on the Fukushima area.
We have some information, but there's a lot we don't know yet. TEPCO released a bit of information throughout the storm and the day after, but we haven't seen a lot of information come out. And of course, that raises tons of questions people have. But this has happened with past storms where they'll put little dribs of information out, and then it'll be days, weeks, sometimes even a month later before we really know the full impact of what has happened at the plant.
What do we know so far about any damage that was caused by Hurricane Hagibis on the still radioactive remains of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant?
They did have quite a bit of time to prepare. With this typhoon, its path was fairly well known, and it didn't deviate from the path that they predicted it in a whole lot. So before it was even approaching Tokyo, they had a pretty good idea it was going to go right up the coast and hit Fukushima Daiichi. That gave TEPCO and all the associated companies time to prepare. So they do things like equipment they have outdoors. They, you know, bring it into a building. All of the big cranes that you see on site, they drop those to the ground. They cancel any work they had scheduled. So they had a couple of days' notice that this was probably going to hit. So this was good. It didn't really catch them by surprise.
On Saturday, TEPCO reported right at the start of the storm hitting that there were irregular readings from sensors monitoring water at the nuclear facility. Now, when TEPCO says there are irregular readings on site, what do they mean, and what does it possibly mean beyond what they're willing to say?
The phrasing they used was really vague, and it gave people kind of an idea that this was something maybe different than what it actually was. What these were is, on site they have all these different systems that handle various tasks related to all the contaminated water on site. They have different machines that do different types of filtration before water goes into the tank systems, and then they have a system that pulls contaminated water out of the reactor building and turbine building basements, and it transfers it to a holding tank that then that water is eventually filtered and put into the storage tank system that you see on the big photos of the plant. So all of those pieces of that system have water leak monitors. So if, you know, a pipe breaks or a gasket gives out and water starts leaking out onto the floor where the system is, they get a warning that, hey, there's something wrong with the system. Somebody needs to go over there and physically look at it. And during the day, there's people monitoring equipment, but like at night and on the weekends, there's not always someone walking around visibly looking at things. So these monitors help them know if something's malfunctioning so they can get somebody over there to try to, you know, stop the equipment before more contaminated water leak all over the floor or out onto the ground. These are the systems that started alarming during the typhoon. What this tells us is that rainwater was leaking in into these various buildings. So these different treatment buildings or different places where they've got a filtration system set up, you know, these systems that were there to catch water from the filtration system actually ended up catching rainwater coming into the buildings.
And the rainwater was creating further leakage, or the rainwater itself was contaminated or became contaminated in the facility? What's the likeliest of those scenarios?
The rainwater that's coming into the various facilities, the monitors they have are very basic. They're just looking for moisture. So it'll be, you know, like a sensor that's on a floor. And it's almost like you can get sensors for your house that if you have water coming into your basement, if this sensor gets covered with water, it'll alarm. And this is kind of the type of sensors they have around these systems. They're not looking for whether the water's contaminated or not. It's just if it's wet, it goes off. But the fact that water is coming in through the roof, it's around these systems in these buildings, and many of these filtration systems are where they have repurposed buildings that were in better condition or weren't heavily contaminated. So you've got water leaking through the roof. You've got water on the floor. It can always pick up any residual contamination that it's found along the way. And as water's coming through, it's also going out. So anytime you have rainwater coming into the buildings or the land at Diachi, you worry about it carrying contamination away with it.
How recently have we had word from TEPCO regarding this?
I did check about 3 hours ago for daily reports, and there was one new report for today. It basically repeated the things they had said on the 13th. They were saying, yes, you know, we had all these rain alarms. They found out they were rain, but, you know, these water alarms from all these different systems, and that the majority of them, they determined, were because of rain, and a couple of them just went off, and they weren't sure why. They didn't find, like, a puddle of water, but it could have just been there was so much moisture in the air that it was enough to set these alarms off. But what they haven't talked about is finding water inside the reactor buildings, and that's what we worry about, is how much water was coming in through, you know, the holes in the roof, the broken walls, all these other things with the damaged reactors, because those buildings are still full of contaminated debris to a certain extent, depending on their unit. So we worry about water coming into those and then moving things out into the environment.
Beyond just the facility itself, there was heavy flooding throughout the area, and that flooding washed away untold numbers of the piled green trash bags that were filled with radioactive soil and leaf and waste that had been part of the so-called decontamination efforts in the surrounding area. Do we know how many of those bags or how much of them were washed away and what happened to them and what risks they might pose?
The one report we've seen through the news has been in a city called Tamura City. It's inland from where Fukushima Daiichi is. That particular site, they've said, has over 2,600 bags on site. They have not said how many washed away. What they're probably going to have to do is do an inventory between how many they know are cataloged on site and how many are left and determine the difference between the two to determine how many got washed away. News report said that 6 bags were found. That doesn't mean that that's all of them. So, you know, we're concerned about how many really did float away.
And also there's the question of how many may have been damaged enough that they leaked their contents into the water, or the bags that were washed away, were they retrieved intact, or was there some loss of content?
Right, and this is something we always worry about. We also don't know the condition of the bags at this particular storage site. When they began doing all this decontamination work and cleaning up and picking up soil and plant debris and putting them in these bags, this was years and years ago. They started this very soon after the disaster. Most of these poly bags they use have a lifespan of about 3 to 5 years before the bag starts degrading. We don't know if this is contaminated debris that is in newer bags or is in older bags, and that will impact the ability of these bags to hold the contents, as you know, if they were to float off. If it's an old bag, the odds of it breaking open are really high. If it's a newer bag, it might hold up better. So we do worry about, you know, how old were these bags, what was actually in them, was it contents that were really high on the scale of radioactive soil, or were they fairly low? But this has been such a problem all along with this soil storage. We've seen photos of miles of these bags stored on beaches. We've seen different sites where they've stored them on a riverbank. And this site in Tamura, Asahi Shimbun has a photo on their website today that shows where these bags fell into the river. And you can see this tall stack of bags, and you could take 3 steps and you would be in this river. And it's just unbelievable. Someone thought that was not a problem.
How likely is it that we are going to learn the truth, let alone in a timely way, about the post-Hagibis radiation spread and hear about it either from TEPCO or the Japanese government?
what we might see is over the next week, we may see some little bits of information come out from TEPCO that, you know, they found leaks or, you know, some changes. It may be up to around November 1st before we see anything. TEPCO tends to like to bury this kind of data in their end of the month reports. And what we look for is we look for changes in the data that we've been monitoring over all these years. We look at things like the reports on the frozen wall. Is it still holding up? Is it having sections that are thawing? We look at all of these wells they've got drilled on site that they monitor the contamination in, and, you know, like the monitoring in the port. And what we look for is we look for changes over time. So, you know, like the readings, what were the readings in September? And what do they show through all of the weeks in October leading up to November 1st? And is there a jump? So that's what we're going to be looking at over the next month to see if we see trends that change. We're also going to be looking to see if there's details that give us a little bit more information about what may have happened there. But there is no outside reporting system. Unless something violates one of Japan's existing nuclear regulation laws, TEPCO is not obligated to report something.
I know that there is a very active citizen activist community in Japan that has been monitoring and recording the radiation levels around the country. Do you know anything, or have you heard anything from those people as to what they either have started doing or are planning to do?
I haven't seen anything new come out of any of the monitoring groups in Japan. This typhoon was huge, and it hit large swaths of Japan. So people that are even not near where Fukushima Daiichi is may be still suffering from cleanup. They may have damage. They may have their power out. So this has really hindered the ability for anyone to go and take readings where they normally would to see if they've changed. Because so many areas are underwater, they're damaged, or the people that would normally take those readings are dealing with the impact of the typhoon themselves.
Nancy, I know that you and Simply Info are going to continue to be on this, and we will be in touch. And if anything happens, do get in touch with us, and we will include it on a future Nuclear Hot Seat.
Great. We'll be keeping an eye out.
Nancy Faust of Simply Info. Other information regarding Hurricane Hagibis, this from Arnie and Maggie Gunderson of Fairwinds Energy Education. They wrote, "It is well known that enormous amounts of radioactive material from the Fukushima meltdowns have settled on the bottom of stream beds and behind levees throughout Japan. As this and other levees and dams burst, they will release even more of that radiation into swollen streams and rivers, where it will settle anew in croplands and populated areas that were previously thought to be cleaned." And Sean McGee of nuclear-news.net urges us to remember that many bags that were not washed away were damaged by the wind and rain. They couldn't help but be. And the radioactive contents spread. As the ground dries, the highly radioactive dirt and dust will be lifted into the atmosphere to be inhaled by people downwind. Also, highly radioactive contamination from the forests above Fukushima, which are millions of square meters, have been washed into areas that have already been cleaned. And drinking water in Tokyo is fed by the waterways that may have been contaminated by the waste. At the very least, the water there needs testing for radionuclides. Officials at Tamura City, which is where the bags were washed into the river, have variously said that they will consult with the Environmental Ministry to determine possible effects on the environment, and then asserting, on the other hand, that the bags will have little impact on the environment, even if they are released into the river. But so soon after the disaster, when cleanup is still just beginning, it is impossible for us to trust the statement by Environment Ministry official Kisuke Takagi when he claimed that it had caused no problem. And here's one additional note. A course correction on some misinformation that has accidentally been spread. The story has been picked up that all 2,667 bags of contaminated soil and plant material were washed away into the river near Tamura City. But as I watched the stories come out of Japan, there was no mention that all of these bags had been washed into the river. That belief came from one improperly written headline on a Taiwan news story that was originally written by the Associated Press. The wording in the story was a little loose and read, "A temporary storage facility containing some 2,667 bags stuffed with radioactive contaminants from the 2011 Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster was unexpectedly inundated by floodwaters brought by Typhoon Hagibis. Torrential rain flooded the storage facility and released the bags into a stream 100 meters away." The imprecision was in the phrase, "released the bags," leaving it open to the headline writer to pick up on the implication that all the bags had been washed away, when, as far as we know at this time, that was not the case. I mention this in order to adhere to the truth of the matter. As you heard, problems in Fukushima post-Hagibis are far from over. Any respreading of radioactive contaminants is terrible, and we must know about and follow this information trail because we know that TEPCO and the Japanese government will try to cover it up. But having said that, it is incumbent upon those of us who oppose nuclear to stick with the facts and not give way to exaggeration, unintentional as it has been. We are not likely to know the full truth on this for at least week or weeks if we ever do find it out at all. Moving on in the news, did you know that an estimated 50 nuclear bombs are stored at a U.S. airbase in Turkey and have become potential bargaining chips in the tense relationship between Washington and Ankara in the wake of the Turkish offensive into Syria? The New York Times reported on Monday, October 14, quoted a senior U.S. official as saying that the bombs had become Turkish President Erdogan's hostages. Dipin Narang, a nuclear expert and political scientist from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, said removing the weapons from Incirlik Air Force Base would not be straightforward. He said, "Extracting them under these circumstances may be incredibly risky, since it would involve removing 50 nuclear weapons from the vaults, moving them on a Turkish base, and flying them out of Turkish airspace. They could be vulnerable to accidents, theft, or attack." Here in the U.S., the closure and dismantling of the Indian Point nuclear reactors 2 and 3 in 2020 and 2021 have raised red flags about the storage and handling of more than 1,700 tons of dangerous radioactive waste. Holtec International, a family-owned corporation based in New Jersey, is slated to purchase and dismantle Indian Point and manage the irradiated nuclear fuel. They're proposing to dispose of the waste in as little as 8 years, though the NRC allows up to 60 years for the process. Richard Webster, legal director for Riverkeeper, said, "Holtec is a company with a record of bribery, lies, and risk-taking. We know the NRC allowed the company into plants in New Jersey and Massachusetts even before objections by citizens' groups were heard." Not heard is correct, because at a public meeting on Wednesday, October 9, with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, over the three-hour session, many of the 90 people crammed into the room were frustrated by an unreliable audio system that made it difficult to hear the speakers. Low-tech obfuscation of a high-tech problem. In the Pacific Northwest, the Department of Energy wants to dodge its cleanup duties at the Hanford Reservation by granting itself the authority to reclassify the extraordinarily toxic nuclear waste at Hanford and call it low-level waste. The Yakima Nation is fighting back, and we will have a link to that article up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, episode 434. And in South Korea, civic groups kicked off a global campaign against potential radiation risks during the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, demanding that Japan ban Fukushima food products and cancel games in the Japanese city. They launched the campaign to protect visitors and athletes from radiation risks and stop the Japanese government from using the Olympics as a tool, quote, to conceal lingering damage from the Fukushima nuclear crisis. And now,
Nuclear hot seat, none that's out of week.
Hey kids, boys and girls, you want to learn some fun facts about nuclear energy and atomic energy? Well, there's a website for that. A company called Sightseen Limited, which operates out of the UK, has come up with not one, but two separate web pages dealing with this atomic nuclear energy. Intended for kids, it clearly soft-pedals the dangers of nuclear. For example, nuclear energy can produce radioactive waste. For example, used reactor fuel, and such materials can be harmful to humans and animals as they may remain radioactive. 24,000 years for the plutonium in used fuel rod. That requires not the conditional may remain radioactive, but does remain radioactive. It goes on to state, these materials have to be handled and disposed of in special ways according to regulations, parens, rules, laws, in order to protect life. Again, the implication is that this is already happening. But it does not define radiation, what it is or what it does, and are led to believe that nuclear is just like the sun, a huge ball of gas that gives off energy all the time. In addition to the disturbing downplaying of any risks of nuclear, there is a small note at the bottom of the webpage that says, all statistical facts on this page are subject to change. But on the plus side, it does state, atomic energy is a non-renewable energy source. That means that non-renewable energy cannot be renewed. Yes, but what does that mean? Talking down to kids is never a good idea, especially when it encompasses their entire genetic future. And that's why Sightseen Limited, with your limited showing of what the dangers are of nuclear, some of the facts kids need to know about, you and your web pages are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
We'll have this week's other featured interview in just a moment, but first, here's my weekly encouragement and pep talk for you to help Nuclear Hot Seat financially with a donation. First, I want to acknowledge those of you who do donate, be it a one-time donation or an ongoing donation every month of $5 or more. Without your help, we wouldn't be here. And where else would you go for this information? You're not exactly getting it from mainstream media, are you? Nuclear Hot Seat is pledged to provide news stories on a wide range of nuclear topics, with information that is verifiably sourced and fact-checked for accuracy, as you just heard in the report about Hurricane Hagibis. Plus, we provide eye-opening interviews with people who are genuine experts on the nuclear industry or aspects of the pushback against it. But all this work takes funding. And to keep the show going, we incur weekly, monthly, and annual costs. That's why we need your help. A donation of any size will help us keep providing you with the nuclear news you can count on. It's very easy to donate. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to send us a one-time donation of any size or set up a recurring donation of any size. And if you want an easy, fast way to support the show while sticking to your budget, we also have a big green donate button, which allows you to set up a recurring donation of just $5 a month. Here in the U.S., that's the price of a cup of coffee with maybe a nice tip to the barista. So, buy Nuclear Hot Seat, the equivalent of a cup of coffee this month and every month. Know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care enough about nuclear issues to want to know the truth. Here's this week's other featured interview. I often hear from people, the nuclear issue is so big, what can one person do? Plenty, as today's guest will demonstrate, regarding Rocky Flats in Arvada, Colorado. There's already a strong, well-defined activist community fighting for total cleanup of that Superfund site. But today's guest found a different way to approach one of the problems at Rocky Flats, a proposed toll road to be built parallel to its border along Indiana Avenue. Randy Stafford has family roots going back several generations in Arvada. In 2017, He heard that the Jefferson Parkway Public Highway Authority Board of Directors was proposing a toll road be built smack up against the border of Rocky Flats along a street called Indiana Avenue, and that they were forming an advisory committee to consult on the proposed toll road. Randy applied for and was selected as one of only 12 members. He attended monthly meetings for a year in 2018, and, as you will hear, he was moved to research and write his own massive position paper opposing the parkway. This is a story with breaking repercussions, as you will learn shortly. I spoke with Randy Stafford initially on Monday, October 7, 2019.
Randy Stafford, so good of you to be with us here today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for having me on, Libby.
First of all, what is your background?
I am a third-generation Jefferson County, Colorado resident and a software architect by profession, a mathematician and computer scientist by education. My mother's family grew up in Arvada near Rocky Flats, and two of her siblings actually worked at the site.
We have a lot of new listeners this week. Give them a little background on what Rocky Flats is and what the problems are with the site.
Rocky Flats was a Atomic Energy Commission and Department of Energy site that manufactured the plutonium cores of the United States nuclear weapons arsenal, a total of 70,000 plutonium cores that went into all of the bombs that the United States has. And over the course of about 40 years of operation, the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant contaminated the surrounding environment with radionuclides like plutonium and americium and uranium, and also volatile organic compounds and quite a few environmental contaminants. And some of those are still present today, and there's a lot of new development happening around the area. And the site was turned into a national wildlife refuge and open to the public.
And of course, National Wildlife Refuge is just one of those phrases or one of those labels that they give to radioactive lands that haven't been cleaned up and can't be cleaned up, and animals don't vote, and the foliage covers what people think a nuclear site is supposed to look like. So while there might be wildlife living there, that does not mean that it's safe for life to be there.
Yes, and just to be perfectly clear, the center of the site is still an active Superfund site and still maintained by the Department of Energy and is not open to public access, but there's a buffer zone around the site, which is the wildlife refuge and is open to the public and is contaminated. And it turns out that Rocky Flats is not the first former nuclear site that was turned into a wildlife refuge. As far as I know, the first one in the United States was Amchitka Island in the Aleutians in Alaska. Amchitka was the site of underground nuclear weapons testing in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and United States Fish and Wildlife Service had employees and their families living there and rehabilitating a species of rare geese, among other projects, afterward.
When and how did you first become aware of the problems at Rocky Flats?
I would say it started with reading Kristen Iverson's book, Full Body Burden, back in 2012.
And what did that book do for you?
Well, it kind of opened my eyes to this drama, really, right in my neck of the woods. I don't live very near the site myself, but it's a really major story in Colorado. And I think a lot of people just aren't aware. We have a lot of immigrants coming to the state from other places in America, and they move to neighborhoods around Rocky Flats, and they have no idea that there was a former nuclear weapons plant there and that the environment is still contaminated.
And of course, we've had Kristen Iverson on the show many times, and her book, Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Atomic Shadow of Rocky Flats, I believe that's the subtitle on it, is a brilliant, well-researched book on exactly what happened there. If people want further information, that's a great place to go. After you read the book, how did you then reach out to the community or become involved in the actions?
Well, the first thing I did was I sent some fan mail to Kristen, and it's been wonderful to get to know her. In about the summer of 2017, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service began hosting these things that they called sharing sessions, where they were sharing information with the public on their plans for the Rocky Flats National Wildlife Refuge. And I attended a couple of those. And my first sort of act related to Rocky Flats was I wrote a letter to the Fish and Wildlife Service's refuge manager for Rocky Flats. And I told him about Amchitka, because my uncle spent his career in fish and wildlife and it was actually the manager of the Alaska Maritime Wildlife Refuge and knew the people and oversaw the operations on Amchitka. And then later, the Jefferson Parkway Public Highway Authority announced that it was selecting citizens for an advisory committee, and I applied to be on that committee and was chosen. So I served on the Jefferson Parkway Advisory Committee for a year in 2018.
Explain to people what the Jefferson Parkway is.
The Jefferson Parkway is the fourth attempt to complete a beltway around Denver. There is existing beltway around Denver from about 12 o'clock on the clock face to 9 o'clock on the clock face. The one quarter section that's missing is roughly the Jefferson Parkway. Three local governments, City of Arvada, City of Broomfield, and Jefferson County, are partnered under a Colorado law to create highway authority to build that missing chunk. And the idea is to have it be a privately constructed and operated toll road. The problem is that the alignment that they have chosen goes right through some of the most contaminated ground at Rocky Flats. On the eastern border of the site, the ground is contaminated with plutonium. And testing just this summer has found a hotspot five times higher than what's allowed there, the hottest hotspot ever found outside the former industrial area. So the concern is that building this four-lane toll road will raise a lot of dust into the air, contaminated dust that can be breathed by, inhaled by workers and downwind residents.
That's a heavy toll to pay just to get a road through there. When you wrote the letter, what was the result of that letter, or was there one?
The way the Jefferson Parkway Advisory Committee operated, we came up with our own agenda, issues that we wanted to discuss, and ultimately the opportunity was to make recommendations to the Jefferson Parkway Public Highway Authority Board of Directors, which consists of elected officials from those three local governments, to make recommendations to them on what to do about certain issues. And some of the committee members were interested in light and sound mitigation and those type of things. I was interested in the public health risk of building the parkway up Indiana Street. And so the purpose of the position paper I wrote that you mentioned was to convince my colleagues on the committee to share my point of view on the risk of building the parkway up Indiana Street. Ultimately, the outcome was the committee made several recommendations to the Highway Authority Board that had to do with the environmental contamination and the public health risk. We recommended more testing. We recommended realigning the parkway. We recommended aggressive dust suppression measures. And it turned out that the board adopted at least one of our recommendations. They adopted the testing recommendation, which has shown this year in 2019 that the area is still highly contaminated. That's one outcome.
And I'd like to point out that the paper that you handed in was 26 pages of your research and compilation and observations and suggestions. Has it had a life beyond the committee and beyond this one piece of influence that it does seem to have had upon them?
It has, and that's actually been really gratifying. I spent a lot of time and effort researching. I was trying to get my hands on every study that has ever been done of off-site soil contamination. And what I mean by off-site is basically along Indiana Street, and every study that's ever been done of public health impact. And I think I succeeded. I found them all. I had to make FOIA requests of Department of Energy. I had to visit the court clerk's office and look at exhibits from some of the lawsuits that have happened over the years. And I spent quite a bit of time in the University of Colorado Libraries archives, where original files have been donated by some of the principal scientists in Rocky Flats history. So I found all these studies and I synthesized them into this position paper. And one of the really gratifying things that happened was the Broomfield City Council had a meeting on December 11th, 2018, where the Highway Authority was asking for $2 million more dollars in 2019. And one of the council members said, well, I've read this position paper and I can't support this funding request. And he didn't know me and I didn't know him. And it was really delightful to watch him cite my paper in the middle of a city council business meeting.
That must have been tremendously gratifying, because usually such a deaf ear is turned towards anyone who comes up with a nuclear-based objection to anything moving forward in the world. So have you attempted, beyond just the group, getting that information out, since Broomfield already had it, to perhaps any of the other organizations or officials who are in charge of making the decisions about the Jefferson Parkway?
Yes, I've sent a link to the paper to quite a few elected officials. In terms of opposing the parkway or opposing the alignment of the parkway, it turned out that a direct way to do that was to try to persuade the Broomfield City Council and the Arvada City Council to either deny the funding that the Highway Authority was requesting or to put conditions on the grant of the funding. So Jefferson County approved the funding without fanfare a year ago. Arvada approved its $2 million on April 1st with an almost unanimous vote, unfortunately. But Broomfield, to their credit, have been very diligent about researching the issue, trying to act responsibly and cautiously with respect to public health. And they will actually probably vote tomorrow night. And so the position paper and the community of citizens who are concerned about Rocky Flats has been influential on the Broomfield City Council. And if they deny the Highway Authority's requested funding or put conditions on it, like the parkway has to be realigned, that will be a real credit to Broomfield in terms of responsible government.
And do all three of these governments have to be in complete agreement before the project can go forward?
Well, yes. It turns out that Broomfield's deliberation has delayed the release of the request for proposals from two companies who would bid on the project to build and operate the parkway. So Broomfield's deliberation has effectively delayed the project by a year by delaying the RFP release, because the Highway Authority won't release the RFP until it knows that all three of its member governments are aligned on going forward.
So where do things stand now, and how do the actions in these three bodies relate to the actions that activists are taking?
So where it stands now is that I think the Highway Authority is waiting for the results of the testing that it has commissioned to be finalized, and that's expected in November. And they are waiting for the city of Broomfield to indicate whether it will fund the budget and provide the funds that were requested. And if Broomfield doesn't, that is kind of an indication by one of the partners that they want out of the authority, or they want to change the plans. Now, this is all subject to the composition of the city council, which will change in November. It's an election year in Broomfield. And so we don't have really a verdict yet. I think we'll get an indication tomorrow night, and it'll be newsworthy.
How has the media been covering this? Have you felt that they've been fair to the oppositional voices raising the objections because of plutonium and americium being in the environment and being tracked in the dust or the dirt or the area around Rocky Flats?
Of course, it depends on the media source. We have some TV stations here in Denver, CBS 4 Denver. There's a reporter named Jeff Todd who's been covering this issue closely. And there's a writer for the Denver Post named John Aguiar who is also covering this issue pretty closely. Their treatment tends to be pretty fair. The testing done by the Highway Authority is not the only testing that's been done this year. Fish and Wildlife has also done some testing. and some of the municipalities have done some testing. And when testing results are reported, you can kind of tell by the slant of the headlines in some of these media sources how they view the issue. Some of them are more cautious and some of them are more pro-refuge, pro-parkway.
I know that you've made some very strong statements about what it would mean if the parkway goes ahead and they don't take the radiation risks into account.
I believe that it is immoral for governments to expose citizens to plutonium contamination in the pursuit of economic development, which is really what the Jefferson Parkway is all about. It's not about a transportation solution. It's about economic development in that quadrant of the Denver metro area. So from my service on the Jefferson Parkway Advisory Committee, I know that the construction plan calls for cut and fill. It means cut the hills and fill the valleys. And so we're talking about convoys of earth movers doing massive soil disturbance, you know, massive relocation of soil. There's a wind farm up there. It's a notoriously windy area. So the prospect is all this soil disturbance raising contaminated dust into the air, and the dust will blow downwind. It'll blow east, southeast towards Broomfield and Arvada, and it'll settle on the properties of residents there. It'll basically redistribute plutonium, and it represents an inhalation hazard to people in the area. That's why I'm on record with, you know, stating my belief that it is immoral for governments to potentially expose citizens to plutonium contamination in pursuit of economic development by building this parkway.
How aware have the residents of the area been made that this is a potential danger to them? And if they don't want to look at it through the vision of their health or their morality, their property values?
I think people are pretty aware. It's been in the news a lot. And there's some evidence to suggest that the concern is having an impact on property value. If you look at home sale data for zip code 80007, the selling price is lower than the asking price, and the days on market is about 60 days on average, which is pretty unusual for Denver metro area real estate. It's been a hot market. But in that particular zip code, which surrounds Rocky Flats, people are not getting what they're asking, and it's taking them a while to sell their homes. And I don't know if that is a result of the concern, but it could be.
Depending upon what the decision is tomorrow night, what is next for the fight back, the pushback to try and stop this parkway or get it rerouted away from Rocky Flats?
Well, I know that the Jefferson County commissioners are watching very closely what happens in Broomfield, and we have already met with a couple of them. And if Broomfield should deny the highway authority's requested funding or put conditions on it, like you have to realign the parkway, we will go to Jefferson County commissioners and say, all right, you've seen what's happened in Broomfield. There's only three commissioners in Jefferson County. Two of them are Democrats, and the Republican is the one who sits on the JPPHA board, Jefferson Parkway Public Highway Authority board. We will go to the two Democratic commissioners, if not all three of them, and just say, look, your county is having financial problems. Why are you spending millions of dollars on this project? Are you not concerned about the public health risk? In fact, the Jefferson County Department of Health director, Dr. Mark Johnson, has been on record saying he is concerned about health risk in the area. So we'll take it partner by partner. Arvada is the hardest nut to crack. Arvada is the municipality that stands to gain the most in terms of economic development by the Jefferson Parkway. But if Broomfield shows cold feet, then we go to Jefferson County and hopefully we change the alignment of this project or kill the project as a whole, one partner at a time.
Randy Stafford, I appreciate the work that you have done on behalf of those people who are living in proximity with Rocky Flats and are facing the possibility of a dust storm of plutonium. Your work is making a difference and hopefully will continue to do so. And I thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, thank you, Libby. Thank you for the show. I've listened to some segments of it before, and it's an honor to be on. Thank you.
Think that's a lot? But wait, there's more. There have been breaking developments in this story, and Randy filled me in when we spoke yesterday, October 14, 2019.
Randy, you said that there was now a major update on this story. What's going on?
City Council meeting Tuesday, October 8th. The deputy city manager, Kevin Stanbridge, reported on a meeting between the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment and the Jefferson Parkway Public Highway Authority, which occurred the day before, Monday, October 7th. And Mr. Stanbridge reported that the state health department would be conducting a new risk assessment of building the parkway up Indiana Street, and they would be considering downwind residents and highway construction workers as at-risk parties. And furthermore, that the new risk assessment would take a year. So I interpreted that to mean that the parkway project is delayed by another year, and I regard it as a success that the state health department is going to conduct a risk assessment, because to date they've been fairly complacent. Now, having said that, I don't have a whole lot of confidence in them because of their historical position on Rocky Flats, but the delay is good and the visibility of this step is good.
This sounds like excellent news all around, and certainly far more positive than I think we were expecting when we spoke a little over a week ago. Now, what kind of follow-up to this do you or any of the local groups have planned that you know of that you can speak about at this time?
Just today I had a meeting with a Jefferson County commissioner, and he was not aware of this meeting between JPPHA and CDPHE, nor Broomfield's participation in it. And you would think that the other two partners in the highway would have been represented there. So we are continuing action with Jefferson County and with Broomfield to have them reconsider their participation in this entire project. Broomfield is going through its budget approval for 2020, and there's a line item in the budget for JPPHA funding for 2020. JPPHA is Jefferson Parkway Public Highway Authority. And so we believe that a majority of Broomfield Council members will oppose the budget line item, and we will continue to lobby them to oppose it until the budget is voted on. So we are continuing political action with two of the three partners in the Public Highway Authority.
That was Randy Stafford, who proved to be a very powerful voice on the advisory committee to the Jefferson Parkway Public Highway Authority Board of Directors. If you would like to read the book that turned around Randy's thinking about the problems at Rocky Flats, I encourage you to get Kristen Iverson's superb book, Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats. It is a brilliantly written, perfectly researched book that is now being made into a movie. Activist shout out! We are just past Indigenous Peoples Day here in the U.S., formerly named Columbus Day. And the call has come out from Indigenous leaders for us to oppose U.S. House Bill H.R. 2699, the Nuclear Waste Policy Amendments Act of 2019. It was recently rammed through the Environment and Climate Subcommittee and would rush the opening of Nevada's Yucca Mountain dump, which was illegally sited on Western Shoshone treaty lands. It would also authorize the U.S. Department of Energy to take ownership of commercial irradiated nuclear fuel at private consolidated interim storage facilities, should they ever be built. So all of us here in the U.S. are being asked to call our congressional representatives, our two senators, and our House of Representatives person, and urge them to oppose H.R. 2699. And did you know that October 24 through 30 is United Nations Disarmament Week? It is. And if you're in the city, you are invited to join with other peace, disarmament, climate, and social justice activists to help count out $1 trillion, the nuclear weapons budget for the next 10 years, and to join a movement to relocate this money to climate protection and the Sustainable Development Goals. Over 7 days and seven nights, activists will be counting out 1 million notes, each with a face value of 1 million, in strategic places around New York to demonstrate exactly how much money is being spent on weapons as opposed to necessary programs to support human life and the future of the planet. It's being put together by the Basel Peace Office, that's as in Basel, Switzerland, and we will post a link up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 434. As for this week's final thought, I believe I've already covered that in what I had to say about the exaggeration of the statistics on Hurricane Hagibis. In which case, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 15, 2019. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net and Sean McGee, deunrenard.wordpress.com and Hervé Courtois, miningawareness.wordpress.com, fairwinds.org and Maggie Gunderson and Arnie Gunderson, taiwannews.com, asahi.com, nhk.or.jp, TheExaminerNews.com, InterContinentalCry.org, National Resources Defense Council, Harvard.edu, KoreaHerald.com, TheGuardian.com, PeaceAndHealthBlog.com, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, fun-facts.org/UK, Beyond Nuclear, and as always, the completely captured and neutered Nuclear Regulatory Commission, where we always like to put regulatory in quotes. A reminder that Nuclear Hot Seat is now available on all your favorite podcast platforms, so what are you waiting for? Subscribe! And if there's a platform we've missed, let us know and we'll load it up there as well. Thanks to all of you for listening and joining with Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers around the world in 123 countries on 6 continents and counting. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week so you don't miss out on a single episode, it's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down looking for the yellow box, and sign up for weekly email links to the latest show. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate weekly, verifiable, fact-checked news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. We are always grateful for your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019. Libby, Halevi, and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that the last thing anyone who opposes nuclear wants to be able to say is, I told you so. That's it. You have all had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.
the Anti-Media Radio with your host Nick Burnaby here on UCY.TV.